Okay.
That's our cold intros.
Yeah, we can be one of those podcasts that starts with like
something
the chatter that was happening before the podcast.
Right. And then it goes into the song. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, we're set up for it because it starts with a song. So like we could just start doing that and it would not disrupt anything.
It would be funny if when Michael was listening to this, that's our editor, he took this clip and was like, you know what? For one episode only, I am going to do the thing where they're chattering before the podcast and then it goes into the theme song.
Hey, Michael, just in case you're wondering, yes, my audio levels are relatively low, so you'll have to add a little filter to make them louder because I have one of those SM7 Shores that very, very quiet on input. So
all the tracks are recorded separately, so Perfect. It should be okay. I am only seeing my track being recorded, though. Does everyone?
I see all three.
Okay,
I see all three of yours. Yeah, I see all three.
Okay, cool. All right, then it doesn't matter. Okay, let's start the show. Welcome to episode number 108 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we bring in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it or done something cool, has an interesting story or topic from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Liu, and I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And fresh off of nearly 48 hours of playing video games for the benefit of the Video Game History Foundation, our guest today is Gerard Khalil of That One Video Gamer. I got the name right, yeah?
Yes, you did.
That One Video Gamer, a.k.a. The Completionist, a.k.a. Dragon Rider, apparently. I just saw it while looking up your name. So Gerard is here today to talk to us about the closure of Nintendo's eShop, having recently published a video on his YouTube channel about exactly what it took for an individual to buy everything for the 3DS and Wii U. And it was fairly absurd and ridiculous. No human should ever have to do it. And that's probably why he did it. Gerard, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you guys for having me. I was wondering when I was going to show up here. So this is the appropriate time. I think we did it. We did it, everyone.
We've been on your stuff. Now you're on ours.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to start this show the same way I started my Twitter thread about this topic. Okay. Because if we don't get that out of the way right away, some people are going to be saying things to us before they finish the podcast. So wait.
Oh, I know where this is going.
First of all, finish the podcast. But second of all, yes, thank you to all of the pirates and other like underground and maybe less conventional preservationists. We very, very, very much acknowledge piracy here at the Video Game History Foundation as a historically vital form of preservation because there have often been no other methods to do so. So I promise we will get to that, but I just want to start off this show by saying we will be talking about the role that, you know, quote unquote, underground preservation plays in all of this. And we're also going to be talking about what Gerard did because they both solve different, but both necessary things. Does that get that out of the way? Are we good?
I think so. Yeah. I think it does.
I think we should read off every YouTube comment that says, why don't you just pirate this? No? Okay.
We'll be here. This will be like the video game history month. We'll just nothing will happen but reading those comments.
Okay. So we will, you know, go look at the show notes, everyone, and watch this video. In fact, pause the podcast if it makes sense. But if it doesn't, keep listening. Gerard, where did this start, right? Like what inspired you to go attempt to purchase every game on the eShop? Was it the announcement of the closure?
That's where it started. That was the very first thing that started the whole avalanche of it all. The closure for me, I am considered a Nintendo ambassador, which means that Nintendo considers me a family-friendly, safe YouTube content creator influencer that won't bury the brand. And I've always been pretty even keeled with them. I've criticized them evenly. I've praised them evenly. You know, people say I'm a shill for Nintendo, which I totally understand and recognize. But when it comes to the retirement of a console and or platforms of said console, Nintendo has not been the greatest. And I know that when the virtual console slash eShop aspect of the Wii U and 3DS started to finally take off, you had a lot of games that hadn't seen the light of day in years kind of copying what the Wii eShop did. And I remember when the Wii eShop closed down, how depressed I was, because there were so many great games that I just did not purchase. I just let it go. And so I know that Nintendo has this habit of just kind of, we're going to bury our old platforms in favor of new platforms and tough cookies. That's it. So that's where it started with it was with the announcement of the closure of the eShop. I felt that this like kind of this bitterness or this upset drive of, well, why do they do that? Like, why can't I should be able to, you know, take my Wii U and or 3DS purchases onto the Nintendo Switch or whatever the next format is. And I know that Nintendo is all about making money and continuing to grow because they're a business and yada, 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 yada. But that just was kind of my pinpoint of, I've been buying Nintendo products since I was a child, and I have been loyal, and I buy the best versions, and I buy two copies of games now, one for me to use on my console, one for me to have my collection. And it wasn't anger. It was more frustration. And once I started to look into what it took to do something like this, I started to realize there was a bigger story to tell here that I think people, you know, they kind of think they knew the story. But I think once we kind of really started to doing what it required, it turned into a whole other beast that the entire time I was thrilled by it, because I was like, oh, this is exactly what I wanted to expose in quotes. It's exactly what I wanted to share, because this shouldn't be the responsibility of one person, let alone no one should have this massive feeling of FOMO to do the thing that I did, knowing that, you know, when March 27th came around, it was over.
So, I mean, let's just start by what exactly happens when a digital storefront shuts down. Like, what are we talking about when the Nintendo eShop closes? Like, what are we losing there, and in what way are we losing it, if that makes sense?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is access, right? You no longer can purchase anything that is on that store. And I think it starts from a place of, oh yeah, I can't, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys can stop me in my stops, but in my tracks, I don't think you guys are concerned about preserving Mario 3 or or new Mario Bros. Wii U or Super Mario 3D World. You know, you're not worried about Mario Party 10, right?
Like, all of these are physical products, right?
Yeah, they're physical products.
And also, as Kelsey hinted at the top of the show, you know, we feel pretty confident about the preservation through piracy of those titles. Yeah.
This is more or less about titles like Games for Toddlers and
Skunky. I was hoping we'd get to that on the show. And
Skunky Bee's Casino Volume 1, right? Like, the idea is we are preserving games that good or bad is not objective. It doesn't matter. These games were on the store. There was a time clock kind of pinned to their lifespan with the announcement of the closure. And now you can't get games like that. They are just gone. Some of them moved on to Steam or got ports to Nintendo Switch. But most of these companies that made these games have gone under and no longer exist. And the project that they made is just full on just disappeared from the database.
Well, and I mean, well, first of all, Kelsey, I think you ran the numbers and we determined it was near or maybe even over 1,000 of the games between the two shops were digital only, right? There's no way to like get these on the secondhand market. They are just literally gone in terms of being able to acquire them. Unless you just get it, like win the lottery and get the one Wii U that had Skunky Bee's poker on it. Which
what cost like $20?
$20. It's not a $20.
That
game.
Studio was charging $20 for games for toddlers. Like they just did not.
But that's interesting history, right? Like I'm actually interested a little bit in this company now. We're going to do some oral history of Skunky Bee.
I know. Well, and like I'm already trying to put together the economic models in my head. It's like there probably just weren't that many. There's not that much competition on the Wii U eShop, and it's a kid-friendly console. And if, you know, if you're a parent just like trying to figure out what do I put on here for my small child, like,
There's an out of touch man with a cigar somewhere here.
That's Skunky Bee.
That's Skunky Bee. I see. but what I wanted to get into actually at this point is like, okay, we know what happened. We know what it means that it happened, but I think it's worth discussing why does a store get shut down, right? So something that we've made very clear at the foundation, you know, in our public statements and such, is that like, we completely understand and acknowledge the economic reality of not keeping a digital storefront alive forever. It literally costs the company money to do that. And I think most people, when they hear that, are like, okay, well, you know, just run it on a crappy server forever. And like, maybe the download speeds suck, but whatever, at least the store's alive. It actually, you know, maintaining an entire storefront and a digital delivery mechanism, like,
well, and the security involved in like
security
credit card numbers and that sort of thing,
and the proprietary services attached to it, you know.
Also, just anecdotally,
that they're paying that they use for some of these services, you know, the code bases that are no longer maintained that they used for, you know, displaying the box art or whatever. Go ahead, Kelsey.
I was just going to say, just anecdotally, we are doing, and I'll talk about this later in the show too, we are doing a study to kind of determine the percentage of game commercial availability right now, which is going to be really bad. It's really bad, folks.
What?
Yeah, I know. Shocking. And, you know, the Sony was trying to shut down the Vita and PS3 stores fairly recently. And the internet was like, you know, that's terrible. We're going to lose so much history. And they were like, OK, we'll keep it up. It doesn't function. I think they're doing kind of what you're saying. The sort of
they're
like
just leaving it on, but ignoring
it. We will leave it on. And if you have a new Sony account, which is what I tried to make like a Video Game History Foundation account, you just get stuck in an endless loop and cannot access the store. There's some there's workarounds for all of this stuff, but the point is they basically just did that. They just sort of left it up, and it's running into all sorts of bugs and problems that make it functionally inaccessible for a lot of people anyways. So like leaving something up to rot doesn't really fix that problem.
Right. And so, I mean, the point here is that like, it is reality that when a digital storefront is no longer making money, a for-profit company like a Nintendo has little reason to maintain it other than, you know, spending money so that people aren't mad at them, you know, like, and that's about it. And that's not worth a lot of money to a company like Nintendo. So point is, we completely understand why it shut down, and it makes a lot of sense. It just kind of sucks. Is I think the perspective of all of us here. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so you see this going on, you kind of decide to expose, to use your words, but I think it's true. Like you were doing air quotes, I believe, at the time, which listeners couldn't see, but I think expose is the correct word. Your goal is to sort of expose what it actually takes to preserve these games through legal means. And I don't know, kind of like guide us through, like, what, where do you even start with that? How do you start mapping this out?
Man, well, a lot of what we did from the beginning was, look, so for those guys that don't know, I have a team to help me produce my content, and Fraser and Michael, God bless them. When I give them a task this gargantuan, the two of them get very mad at me because it means that whatever project they're working on, they have to stop and do this. And so I went to Michael and I told him what we were doing, and the immediate disdain that he had for me, like, I've known Michael since we were kids. You know, we've been best friends for many years. I have never seen him get that mad when I told him I want to buy every single Wii U and 3DS game from the store, because he knew that before I was going to pitch it to my brother or to sponsors or to anything, that I wanted airtight research, which meant that he had to do all the pre-planning. So what he did was he made within the own scope an Excel spreadsheet, and he took out his Wii U and he went title by title and he acted as if he was going to purchase it. And he clicked on it on the Wii U shop, wrote the name, the developer, and the size of the game and how much the cost was. That's what he did for a weekend. And then, and in the beginning, it was, let's just do Wii U. Then a week went by and I was like, let's do 3DS. And he got even more mad. He was like, why didn't you tell me this from the beginning? I could have done it before. And I said, because it's going to be even crazier. So we started doing 3DS, and then we'll talk about that later on. But we were able to map out what the cost was. And the cost on the first initial assessment was $18,000. Now, the reason why it ballooned up to $23,000 was because Michael did not consider that I wanted to purchase everything, including Virtual Console, DLC, and DSiWare. So when we were mapping it out, there was a huge gap of data that was not in our systems. And Michael was really upset. He's like, I wish you'd known that from the beginning. And I go, right, but what's our brand? We are the completionist. So we have to complete the things that we say we do. And immediately he just let out a huge sigh and was like, okay, boss, I'll go back and do it. So that took about maybe a month for Michael to map out our entire journey from start to finish. And then we spent another 6 to 8 months trying to convince someone to give us money to do this, because I can talk about this for hours, but YouTubers don't make as much money as everyone thinks unless you are in a larger bracket of content creator. I am not in the larger bracket. We've always been the little engine that could. We're scrappy. We try our best to present that we have all the money in the world, but we just simply don't. And so a lot of our offsetting cost of this was, hey, if we get one sponsor to pay for the whole video, we're gold. And it could be something like a Honey or a NordVPN or someone who can work adjacently to the brand and not inhibit the brand. You know, we didn't want it to be like, you know, hey, this video is brought to you by Sony or Microsoft. We wanted it to be, you know, a clean cut. This is an appropriate brand that would match the content. And so we had
the idea of Sony. I can't get over that.
It would have been sick if someone did that. But we tried for, I think, 6 to 7 months, and our agents were struggling to pitch the video because.
Well, I want to know, was there pushback from the people you were pitching to? Were they like, this content doesn't align with our brand or something like that?
Almost all of them said, this is a gamble. You have nothing like this type of content on your channel. There is not a road path or rubric or previous example that you can send to us that this would make a huge difference in the gaming industry. And I kept telling them,
it's Mr. Beast at my scale. Like, right, that's literally what it is.
Yeah. I try. It's like, and I'm much cheaper than Mr. Beast in comparison, right? Like, you're getting a viral stunt video for what it's worth at the behest of video game preservation, and you get to be the good guys that foot the bill. And no one wanted to play ball. And even when I was trying to find piecing together sponsors, I kept telling them, hey, I could make a video about your game, or I could do a little quick plugging your product, or you can spend double the amount and get a really kick-ass integration that makes you the heroes of gaming. And everyone was like, no, I'm good. I'll just do the regular integration. Thank you. And it's not that, like, $23,000 sounds like a lot of money, but most sponsors will pay a successful content creator anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000, depending on the size and scope of the project. And so I just wanted my cost. I didn't even want production costs, or I didn't want anything of that nature.
I just wanted them to buy the games, right?
I just wanted money for the eShop cards, because then the rest I can do it. And so after so many months of pitching and pitching and pitching, one of my agents just came with the idea and said, hey, why don't we just go get micro influencer deals and just, you make them, don't tell anyone about the eShop project, and you just, we you know, CAA, my agency, will not take their cut. We'll just help you get the video made, and you just make it, and we'll square even on another deal. And I said, I appreciate it. Let's do that approach. So we got four sponsors of various sizes and shapes to step in and do indirectly fund this project. And that was the biggest hurdle in the beginning, that no one really understood how important it was, because the minute you say it's like for charity or for a cause or anything that's like a little more than just it's a video game video, it makes people go, well, why don't you just donate that money to our charity, or why don't you just work with us to do something like that, and we'll give you more resources but at a reduced rate for your compensation. And it's like, well, that's not the point. The point is, wow, I want to make my video. I don't want to make your video. I want to make the thing that I want to do, and I need you to trust me that this is going to be for a good cause. And so that was a huge hurdle in the beginning that and it's funny, because now that we've done the video, we get a lot of sponsors now who are like, hey, how do we make a video like that? Mm-hmm. And I go, well,
weird. I told you you'd be the hero.
When I tell them, hey, you know, there are a few shops that haven't closed yet that will close soon, that if you want to play ball, we can do it. It's going to be much more expensive. There's more games, but like, we can start that narrative again now. And especially because stuff like PS3 and 360 are even more difficult to emulate / preserve. So, I'm down to play ball. Like, I'm sponsors, if you want to do it again, I'm ready. I'm ready to tell another story. But yeah, that was rough, because it definitely felt like no one believed in us, which felt like this was, you know, the kind of the nail in the coffin. I think after we talked to you guys about the initial concept of the video, you know, your guys' confidence in our work and what we were trying to pitch, I think, is what fueled us to keep going. Because we knew going into it that everyone was going to say, just emulate it, bro. Just pirate it. It's already been backed up. What are you doing? And I think, you know, talking with you guys so much and you guys giving us that confidence really helped us, because if you did not support us in that way, we would not have made this video. That is the God honest truth.
Well, and Kelsey, I think this is a good time to sort of talk about, you know, where we were when we heard about this video, and, you know, why we were so excited beyond just being like, oh, that's great content and we do believe in you that this will be good content. Like, it actually fit in with like our initiatives.
I think this is a good segue into that, which is so, you know, the Video Game History Foundation in general doesn't do a lot of like collecting of video games. We're primarily a research archive. We are primarily in service to people, you know, telling stories. And so we do a lot of collecting, like, things like video game design documents and magazines and internal correspondence and anything like that that is sort of, you know, more about learning how a game was made or marketed or that sort of thing. But,
and just to jump in real quick, the reason being that we believe that individuals are doing an okay job already of purchasing and preserving retail video games.
Sure. Yeah. And also, like,
we understand they're important. We just don't.
Yes.
We the work's being done between piracy and individuals. It's being done, so we don't do it.
Yeah. So the one sort of exception to this is that we started realizing that we at least need to get somewhat involved in this issue of, hey, there is actually no way of accessing a lot of these games other than piracy. And sort of fighting for that to not be the case. Basically right now, the way the library system is set up in the United, we're going to be talking entirely about the United States because that's where we are. I am not super familiar with the copyright systems in other countries, but, you know, there's not a good way for libraries here to be collecting games. Collecting physical games, okay. Like, you might go to your local library and you might see that they have like a PS4 section or something like that that people can maybe rent out, and they probably don't have the equipment themselves. But it's a very, very, like, you know, there's not like an institutional level, like, kind of research archive of video games in very many places. And what places do have that tend to be just very, I don't want to say haphazard, but it's pretty much just people who donate, like, I have this stack of 360 games, here you go. And not like a full, you know, complete library of any video game you can possibly do. That's, you know, a legal way of accessing a video game right now is to go to a library that has a physical copy of a game and take that physical copy out of that library or play it inside that library. When it comes to digital games, they are now stuck on a console. So if you are a library that wants to, let's say, allow people to play some 3DS games, you, or some digital 3DS games, I should say, you now have to maintain a 3DS, that hardware, that specific piece of hardware. You have to download the games on it yourself. And then you have to let, you know, researchers or whoever come into the library and rent out that specific system. And they, it's probably too valuable to let people leave with it. So it's like, play it on site. And if this is all sounding like it doesn't make any sense and like no one would ever do that and it's not a good way to play or research video games, yeah, you're right. That it's a terrible, terrible system right now. The other thing that libraries can do is that if they want to share like a digital version of a book, an ebook, or a digital version of music or a movie or something like that, they can totally do that. You do not have to go get a physical DVD from a library. You can digitally rent a lot of things from a library. You can experience them at home. You don't even have to go into the library. And, you know, that's a much more reasonable, especially in our world today, where like a lot of things are digital born, that's a much more reasonable way to access things. So video games are very specifically exempt right now from this. There's not a good way of accessing them. And so libraries, for the most part, just kind of don't bother collecting them because it's such a pain in the butt and it wouldn't really serve anybody. Like, it wouldn't actually, no one would actually go to that library to sit in the library and play a digital 3DS game on the library's one singular 3DS. They're just going to pirate it because that's way easier. Frank, you look like you want to jump in.
Oh, not really. But I mean, just, and also, you know, the other side of that is like libraries don't bother collecting because it is absurd. Right. The ask of not only digitally collecting, but maintaining this hardware. And so, you know, kind of bringing it back to where we were, like this is where our minds were already, because, you know, while we're not actively playing this ridiculous game that Gerard had to play and collecting digital games, we are involving ourselves in trying to rewrite the rules, I guess, right, of what this stupid game is, right? Like how do institutions provide access to games? And I think what made us so excited about what Gerard was doing, you know, Gerard, I think for you it was, I want to expose how ridiculous this is for a person to do. But for us, it's like, oh, you know, this also exposes how ridiculous it would be for a library to do. Like, and yeah, we can sort of tack onto this and be like, this is the current expectation if the store still exists, right?
Right.
Once the store no longer exists, there is no expectation. There is literally no path for us to provide this stuff.
So yeah, so when we're talking to, you know, people who represent like the Entertainment Software Association, for example, who are the people who, you know, are basically fighting against giving institutions these exemptions, you know, they like to say like, no, we agree with game preservation. Like we like saving video game history. You know, we support reasonable efforts of preservation. And
we support physical video games in libraries by allowing that to happen and not fighting it is basically right. The ESA's stance. Yeah.
Yeah. But also,
we support video game preservation by not attempting to dismantle the concept of a library is basically their argument.
We support the idea of video game preservation by not legally taking down institutions that are designed to help preserve this.
Right. Yeah.
so stupid.
So, I mean, like, this is just when we heard about this project, I mean, at least for me, my first thought was like, oh my God, this is going to be incredible ammo to be like, does this look reasonable to you? Is this like, you know, watch this 20-minute video that Gerard put out and then tell me if you think that is something that a library should be forced to do. And then on top of that, the only thing that they can do with that after they've spent, mm-hmm. I mean, we'll get into exactly how much money and time and effort and everything went into this, but like after they've done all of that, the only way people can access is to walk on site and, you know, play with this exact 3DS.
Right, because you cannot transfer the games, I don't think, to a new console. Like, it has to be tied to... I mean, Gerard, I think you need to, like, surrender your account to us, even, is what I'm wondering.
It's not so much the account. I just need to give you guys the password so you can use it. But you won't need to because it's physically on the hardware. Unless you guys are trying to download something from... re-download something from the eShop, because that's the other thing that I think is a weird, like, anecdotal thing about the store that you can do, is that even though the eShop is gone, you can still digitally re-download any of the games you purchased. So it's like...
For now,
right. Yeah. So, yeah. Like, you know, which I didn't realize was a function until I... So when I started the Wii U video... I was using my launch Wii U at first, and I was like, I'm not going to use my launch Wii U. God only knows how long this is going to last, because I used to use this thing for all of my entire career. So I bought a like new Wii U to transfer everything over, and so I did. And upon transferring everything over, both my Wii U that I got on launch and the new Wii U that I had purchased bricked. It broke. So I had to go get another.
That wasn't in your video. God, it was not. So
it was,
much.
It was originally in the video, but Michael was all about time. He was like, I don't want to inundate anyone with information that wasn't pertinent to our story. And I was like, that to me is the story, like to show you how backwards this all is. Because now with the Switch, it's not an issue. You can just log into a Switch and start downloading your old games right away, as long as it's the primary account, or that you understand that not multiple people can log in at once. I have several Wii U consoles in my office. And so we have a Wii U kiosk that was given to us from Nintendo. And so that Wii U kiosk had only been used a handful of times. So I just pulled the console out of that kiosk, and that is what I used to start our journey. Already from the get-go, there were issues that that plagued us. But when we give you guys the consoles, it should just work as is, no problem.
Okay. Cool. You know, I don't want to just repeat the whole video, right?
Sure.
But just I mean, that's sort of one of the early struggles, but you know, I think we should just go through like what it actually took, kind of bullet point style. And I'll just let you go because you're already nodding. I'm gonna share.
The first thing was buying the cards. That was a really hard thing to do, just because.
Well, why did you go physical cards?
So a lot of it was misinterpretation in the beginning. So we thought that the ability to purchase anything on the eShop was gone on the original August date, which meant that we had to buy all of the cards as soon as possible and do this whole mad dash. But what we realized is that just the ability to use a credit card on the console itself was being retired. So with that said, we were like, then the only way to redeem stuff is by using gift cards. But Nintendo, we also didn't know at the time, Nintendo introduced a function to merge your 3DS and Wii U account to your Switch account. So as long as a balance was on your Switch account, you could have just used your Nintendo Switch to buy your currency, and then it would show up in the Wii U and the 3DS, no problem. But we didn't know that at the time in the video. So we just said the safest, secure way to do this is with gift cards. And as someone who's worked retail his whole life, especially at big box stores like Best Buy and GameStop, I knew the regulations that they were only going to allow us to sell so many, to buy so many cards. So that's why we broke into teams of three, all with our own credit cards. And the South Bay area did not have eShop cards for probably at least 2 months, specifically the $50 Link cards. No one sold the Bowser or the Donkey Kong $75-$100 cards. It was only the biggest amount they would hold was the Link cards.
Interesting.
So we have, that's why in the video you can see, aside from like one or two Marios and a couple of Peach cards, every card we purchased was a Link card. We knew that if we did it through digital services, that our credit cards would get flagged to all hell and the bank would cut our cards and they would say, you need to order new cards. So I called the bank in advance dozens of times, like the Monday before, the Tuesday before. I would call once a day and say, I'm letting you know on this coming Sunday, I am doing this and I need someone to just be on the ones and twos to ensure that when we get stopped, it won't happen. And we didn't show it in the video, but there were times where we called the bank while we're at Target, and the woman who's on the phone with us was the same woman we've talked to the entire time. And she's like, I don't understand what's going on. I've cleared up the blocks. You should be good to go. And I told her, I'm at Target and they won't sell me the cards because I'm getting declined. And she goes, well, your limit is more than enough to your total number here. So you should be just fine. So we got close to 18,000 that first day. It's like 17,500 something.
Oh, and all then, those video clips are actually from one day.
Like from one, was a one the, day. The one of all of us together with like Phil wow. and myself, that was all from one day. And so we did like 95% of the lion's share in one sprint of a day. And then over the course of like a week or two, I would start visiting other Best Buys in the area and Home Depots and Lowe's. And when my credit card finally got cleared up, I purchased the remaining balance. We even shot a separate video where we realized that we were short. And so I went back to Best Buy to buy the cards. And one of my former managers was like, you can't keep doing this, Gerard. We need these cards. Stop doing it. But we decided not to use it just because, again, it was bloating that runtime and we wanted it to be as clear as possible.
So, we love getting this cutting room floor stuff talked about on the show, though. Like, honestly, like we do this with everyone, so this is good.
Yeah. So we got all the money, we went back to the office, and immediately we ran into a few problems that we didn't anticipate, which I feel like most people now know because of what we went through. But if you're not aware of it, deciding like there's no Wii U game that costs more than $100 on the Wii U or 3DS or even the Nintendo Switch eShop, right? So how are we going to expect that the soft limit in the hard in the software in the soft limit in the hardware store is $250? So that meant we had to spend five cards, spend all the money, redeem five cards, spend all the money, redeem five cards, spend all the money. So we do this in that first that the day after we bought the eShop cards, we got together and started to do this process.
And we first of all, I want to pause there because like that's actually a really, I mean, I get that it's some kind of, you know, protection for them, right? That limit, but it's like I don't think it's that crazy that someone of not particularly affluent background might want to for Christmas be like, you have $500 to spend on video games. Like, you know, like that doesn't sound that wild to me.
500 doesn't sound wild. Yeah. I'd even argue 1,000 doesn't sound that wild, depending on what you're doing, right? Like I am the worst person to buy a gift for, and my family just gives me gift cards, and I get up to anywhere from $50 to $1,000, depending on the year and whatever. And it's always like, because people just don't know what to do. It's like, just go have fun. But also, Nintendo is like, don't spend $1,000 in our store all at once. So that was a key factor in the beginning. And so we went for a few hours. We got like a couple dozen games in. I want to say around like game 30 or 40 on the Wii U or 3D. We did 3DS first because we knew there was quadruple the amount of games on 3DS and then were Wii U. So
real quick. When you hit this limit, do you also have to download them before you move on, or can they just be purchased and you can download later?
They can for Wii U, you could it depends. So so the reason why it's going to take some time to give you guys all of our hard drives and data is that we were running out of time on the project, and so the last hard drive and the last two memory cards don't actually have everything physically backed up. They just have the receipt of all the things we purchased because we ran into that problem of our cards were full and we needed to act quicker, and it was quicker for us. We could purchase 3 times the amount of games if we didn't download them, but the system forced you to download them, and unless the hard drive or the card was full, you could not purchase them. So it was actually a speedrunning tactic for us to not download the game, to just literally purchase it and then after the fact re-download it. Otherwise we'd be stuck. And the 3DS has a 10 game download limit. The Wii U has no limit. So for the Wii U, we would just hit download later, download later, download later. And eventually it slowed the Wii U down so much that it would take 10 minutes just to move from one page to another. And not even like to change the games. It would be like to press the icon to purchase 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
To press the icon to authorize the purchase 10 minutes. To then go ahead and press the download button 10 minutes.
Is this like after a reset of the console and everything too?
This is while everything is downloading. So if you are just stacking your downloads on the Wii U, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes of data, that's essentially what would happen. So yeah, we learned quickly.
Not something tested by Nintendo.
Yeah. And I don't think they don't anticipate that someone was going to do this, right? And that it makes sense.
But again, if the under the current way that the law works, the only way a library could have these games, and like the only legal quote unquote preservation of these games, is what you did. Mm-hmm. And that's insane.
Yeah.
So they should care.
That's when we ran into our second problem, which was the amount that you could purchase in a given day was soft locked at anywhere between $1,500 to $2,000. So when we finally redeemed 15 cards worth of currency, we'd get another error code that was not listed anywhere online. This error code,
no one had experienced this error code.
Yeah. Right. So I called Nintendo Hotline several times and I would talk to someone, and every time I talked to them, they were so confused because they did not recognize this error code. It was not in their database, and it always ended with them reaching out to someone higher up or eventually hitting Japan and saying, what is this error code? And I would tell them in advance, I know what this error code is because this is the 5th time I've called in the last month. And this is the issue. I just need you guys to clear or authorize it. And every time I'd ask, they say, we can't. We don't have the infrastructure to do that. You have to just wait. And so there were days where we would have to, you know, buy the games on a Monday and then get locked out by Monday night, wait Tuesday, wait Wednesday, try again Thursday. Thursday, it's free. Great. Pick it back up. Start it again. And then we'd be locked out till Sunday. And so we were only really able to download games about 3 days a week. And the sad thing is that it wasn't about data limit. It wasn't about downloading speeds. It was literally Nintendo said, based on our hardware and based on our software systems, you cannot spend more money than we're allowing you to. Which, I recognize it and I understand it. But I clearly am frustrated by this, and you know, Nintendo support can only do so much. And it's funny because most people I talked to at Nintendo support, they would freak out knowing who I was. So I'd be on the call and they'd go, oh my God, you're Gerard the Completionist, this is so cool, what's going on? And I tell them and they go, wow, I can't wait to
see. How would you like to help me complete something?
Yes. And that's honestly why I was able to get as high up as I did, because wow. Almost every time I called, I spoke to someone who recognized who I was. And it was
add that to the list of what would be expected from a library, right? Like you have to be famous enough that customer service gets excited and wants to help.
And it was so funny, because what ended up happening half the time was I would hit that higher echelon of customer service, and then it would be someone's job to deliver the bad news, right? And so what would happen is one person would call me a couple days later and say, I'm so sorry, your account's been restored, but there's nothing we can do. One person would call, and then 5 minutes later, I'd get another call from Nintendo because someone at the customer service support system saw my name in a follow-up system and got excited at the opportunity to talk to me. So they would call being very excited to talk to me and then quickly realize, oh, I'm about to give some bad news he doesn't want to hear. And that happened 5 times in one day where for an hour, I kept getting a call from Nintendo of support because people were so pumped that they got to talk to me, not understanding the context as to why. They just wanted to talk to me and help me. And they realized halfway through the call, they actually couldn't help me, which made them the bearer of bad news. And it happened so much that I just felt bad because, sorry, but like you have to give me news that I don't want to hear.
It is not your fault. I recognize that it's not your fault.
I forgive you, but also I am mad at your company.
They're used to that at Nintendo, I promise.
So from there, we started running into more problems like games were disappearing from the store. You know, we had a master list of all of our Wii U and 3DS games. And to kind of go back to that master list I was talking about earlier with our producer, Michael, he did not make a master list for 3DS. Because there were games that were disappearing and reappearing in real time every day. And in order, we didn't talk about this at all. And it's so hard to sparse down in the video. To buy a Wii U game is awesome because you can quick jump to pages and you can make bookmarks and save to later and all this stuff to go, I'm downloading this game right now down this list and moving on to the next page. For 3DS, you have to individually go through every single page one by one. You cannot skip to page numbers. You cannot skip ahead. And there were 69 pages worth of games that we had to go through. So I would purchase a page and a half worth of games, reload the cards, reboot the system, go to page 2.5, continue where I left off, hit page 4, shut it down. That sounds fine in the beginning, but when your memory card gets full and you're on page 45 and you switch cards, that's you going through 45 different pages individually to finally get caught up to where you are. And then once you're there, you have to pray to God that it's not a DSiWare game because you can't migrate that naturally. And you have to pray that you've got enough currency. Otherwise, if you shut down your 3DS for the night and you boot it back up, you got to reboot that store and go back at it again. And so nothing was scarier to me and the team. We didn't talk about in the video, and I wish we did. When Metroid Prime Remastered got re-released on the Nintendo Switch store, the services of the Switch and the Wii U and 3DS are all in the same thing. So you can imagine my frustration when we are weeks away from this project being done and I can't log into the Wii U and 3DS store because everyone and their mother is purchasing and downloading Metroid Prime Remastered and I'm just trying to download Brick Breaker number 14 and I can't because the eShop has come to a crawl. And that was like that for almost a week. And we were, again, this game was all about time. We were losing time with each and every passing week with what was happening. And so it made this journey so much more unnecessarily large than we thought about. And to me, I was laughing the entire time because I was like, this is a great story. This is a great, people are going to see this story and it's going to exemplify why this is necessary, right? It's going to tell people, hey, this crazy story we're telling you is the reason why you should be concerned. Because if I went through this, and you want to do this thing or you want to check this out, you cannot. This is what the system allows us to do. And then from there, it gets even worse. You know, 300 icons on a Wii U and 3DS system, which is crazy to me because I've got more than enough data and there's more than enough icons to actually sort. You can create folders in the Wii U and 3DS. The Wii U should be able to hold all 866 games, no problem. Like for preserved play, each folder icon was 15 games. And there's at least a grid of like 50 icons. So that's more than 800, hands down.
Right.
But the system doesn't allow it. So we just got screwed. 3DS, there's even more. There's more systems. I thought that with one hard drive and one really large SD card, I could preserve every single game. And I could not. I had to buy multiple hard drives, multiple memory cards, just because of this weird icon limit. And it just seemed so wrong. It just seemed so stupid. And everywhere I read, the number one solution was just download homebrew software and crack it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with all people dunking on me, what is the point of legally downloading these games if I could just crack the system at that one element? And also, it puts a big target on my back as an official Nintendo brand ambassador, right? Like,
right.
I do not want to destroy my relationship with Nintendo. Not that there's really one there to begin with anyways right now, but still, like, I don't want them to send their lawyers and their legal team at me. If I am the guy that's like, I encourage piracy, like, that doesn't work in any way, shape, or form to tell the story effectively. And it would have changed the narrative completely, which is why we chose not to talk about piracy at all, because it felt like the elephant in the room that you don't need to say. Right? Like, do you need to go to the movies to watch a new movie? No, you could pirate it, sure. But, like, that doesn't change the aspect of you still need to go to the movie theater to buy a ticket to then watch it. And so,
well, there was, and just, for me, if I could jump in here, yeah, like, I think there's a couple things here, but, you know, one of them is that no matter what, that's just not a solution for everybody. Like, I know people who work in software development who are like, who feel this barrier of like, you know, cracking their console, right? Like, people who fundamentally understand this still have this mental block of like, this sounds hard, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
I want to just buy the stuff. So, like, yes, that is, piracy is a solution for people who are comfortable with it, not only from a copyright perspective, but from just a technical perspective, right? That's actually a big ask for a lot of people, is to be comfortable with those two things. And it's, you know, it's like, why don't you just change your own oil on the car? Anyone could do that. You know what it's like? I'm never going to change the oil on my car, right? Yeah. Like, that's just not, I'm never going to do that, even though I can. I just want a solution. Like, I just want to pay someone and it gets done. And I think it's the same for games. So that's one thing. But, you know, the other thing is basically, you know, our interest for the most part in this, right? Which is that, like, sure, an individual can do that. But, like, that being the only solution is crazy. Like, that being the only solution that the industry allows, like, personally, my perspective, I don't think this is the foundation's perspective, but I almost feel like between the lines, the industry is condoning its own piracy.
Yeah, by not. I don't think that's incorrect. I mean, I think that's, I don't know. I think I'm just going to repeat real quick some of the stuff I wrote in the Twitter thread, because it's still just completely true and relevant with this, is that, you know, we rely too much on the continued charity work of people who are doing, like, you know, the piracy and sort of underground preservation. And also, like, redundancy is vital to preservation. There should never only be one literal solution. You know, we should not have to expect or require piracy as the only solution. And now, I mean, yes, Gerard, you managed to pull this off. But if someone who, like, was born, you know, 3 weeks ago or whatever wants to do this someday, they just can't. They only have the piracy option. They literally only have the piracy option. And, you know, just to kind of bring this back full circle to what this could do and what this, you know, I think I mentioned before, basically, right now, if you were to hand all of this over to a library, you know, like ours or like another, they could maintain it and have people come look at it on site, but that's still not a good solution. That's still a terrible, terrible solution. So, you know, one of the things that we are working to change is trying to let people access this stuff legally and digitally, you know, and remotely. Like, they should be able to use emulation as a service to play a 3DS game from their house rather than having to go into a library and you know, and sit down with the library's one 3DS. And when that happens, like, and I'm saying when, because I really do believe in these exemptions, because it just, it makes no sense otherwise. When that happens, we're going to need a clean set of ROMs to work from, you know, we're going to need a set of like, these were all given legally. This was not a set of pirated ROMs. These were all legitimately purchased, and we can start working from that.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's like, do we have a solution right now? No, absolutely not. You know, like, I don't even know, honestly, if, like, if you handed the stuff to us right now, I don't actually know that it's legally airtight. It's like, this is now ours. I don't know. Like, this is something we've not even explored legally. But what I do know is that if anyone is to offer these games through legal institutional means ever, right, I do not believe that Nintendo will donate to them. I don't think they even can, right? Like, I don't even think they have a system in place where it's like third-party software can be given away by them. I really doubt that. So, so we couldn't use Nintendo to acquire these. We definitely couldn't use piracy to legally ingest these things, right?
No.
So if there is even a theoretical path for friggin' institution, if there is any even theoretical legal path ever again to access these games that you cannot buy anymore, like, it's gonna have to start with this collection that is being donated to us. That and again, it's like, okay, the exploration kind of starts now. So like, okay, how do we turn this into legal access? Because there's no other starting point. And I want to emphasize, there's no other legal collection of all of these games. You know, like, I doubt that, you know, 95% of the digital only games will ever be donated ever again to an institution. You know, and so this is really it in terms of like even theoretical access legally to these games. And so, you know, that's why it's so big for us, right? It's not, I think a lot of people, you know, kind of jump to the conclusion that's like, okay, it's done, they're saved, and now an institution has them, and now they can provide access to us. And, you know, we're getting questions already, like, how do I play these? You know, and it's like, we don't know. Like,
yeah, we're on step one of like 10, and
it might be decades, honestly. You know what I mean? Like, it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I have high hopes for the laws, the tides of the laws changing in our favor sooner rather than later. But what we won't be able to solve, you know, the second the legal switch flips on is like the technology needed to actually, you know, create that infrastructure. So that'll start being one of the steps as well. And yeah, it's, I don't know, I think people just kind of don't realize the scope of how much this will take. And already, especially after seeing what you went through, you and your team, yeah, went through, Gerard, like that was only step one is crazy. Like, that was, I mean, can we just read off some numbers here? That was 328 days, 464 eShop cards, and what, like $23,000? That was step one.
Do you have an estimate of hours of labor? Is that something you estimated?
Oh my gosh. I mean,
because, like, at least for us, there's a cost associated with that as well.
Oh,
like,
man.
We've identified our hourly internal cost, and it's not pretty.
It's, I mean, it would be at the very least. So what we would do, at least for the 3DS and the Wii U, is that we would, Cameron, my producer, and myself, we basically would download games at the same time for Wii U and 3DS for a couple days, which was faster because we hit those financial caps faster, but we made a lot more progress on both consoles. Minimum, I mean, if you took me and him together at 4 days a week, you know, going at least an 8 to 10 hour day just dedicated to that, which we did very, very much do that. You know, you're talking 160 hours a week times 4 weeks times almost 10 months, 11 months, like,
that's more than $22,000.
Oh yeah,
that's a lot more than $22,000.
And like, and you know, am I the owner of the company? Yes. Did I pay several employees to do this with me? Yes. But like, it's what I had to do. It's right. What was necessary to get the job done. And you know, was I stoked about it? No. But it told a story, and hopefully that story resonates with people. And the nice thing is that, you know, I had GDC and DICE happen, or I had GDC and PAX happen the week after the video came out. And so, you know, I saw you guys at your headquarters. I met with dozens of developers and fans alike who could not stop talking about the video. And at PAX East, I was slammed with people asking me to sign, like, people were asking me to sign their, like, memory cards and hard drives for their consoles because they were like,
that's cute.
So, you know, it was, I think the, whether or not the story was effective, the awareness is what it was about. And I think knowing that so many people were out there concerned as much as we were just made the whole trek worth the journey.
Well, my experience is that even for fundamentally easy to understand concepts like this shop went away forever and you can't get these games anymore, you know, like, I actually think that humans need something easily digestible to make sense of it. Like, you know, and this video takes this obtuse concept and turns it into reality in a way that I think wakes some people up, right? Like, I think we all maybe become content with, like, well, that's just how it works, right? And I'm very much guilty of this. I'm like, yeah, that's how it works, just pirate, right? But when you actually zoom out and show the mechanics of it and show how ridiculous it is and, like, start explaining it, you know, to your parents when they ask, right? It's like, it's just a reminder of, like, no, the way things are, that's not something we just become content with. Like, the way things are is weird. The way things are is, like, actually really, really weird. And so, yeah, I think this is a valuable tool no matter what. And I think it starts discussion, not because no one knew this. It's just no one really, like, was able to comprehend it until it was expressed and shown in a video like you made. And so I actually think that it makes a lot of sense that this opened a lot of discussion and continues to open discussion. And we're certainly using it for our own discussions with people at this point.
I mean, look, I don't want to say that I'd love to go with you guys when you go fight in the course for this, but if you want me to, I would love to sit in and just be a fly in the wall in the, you know, in that room, just to be like, yeah, I'm the that did this and it sucked, so let me tell you why this was a pain in the ass and why this should never happen ever again.
I'm gonna consult the lawyers who are gonna be the people who are doing the actual talking, because you don't want either of us talking. We're not right. Lawyers, but but they might want your statements. I don't know.
Well, also the hearings are publicly viewable because this is That's a public true. Policy change. And I watched them last time, so I watched those ESA lawyers and I got all steamed up.
I watched them say that software was okay, but not video games. And no, we're not going to attempt to define what the difference between software and a video game is.
We said this earlier, but I want to reiterate that, like, there are exemptions for institutions like ours to provide digital access if we own copies for books, for recorded audio, for recorded video, and for software, but not games. And the argument that was successfully made is that if libraries provided free access to video games remotely, no one would buy video games ever again. For some reason, that only applies to video games. It doesn't apply to books. It doesn't apply to movies. Only video games. That was the successful argument made, and kind of makes me sick, to be honest.
If that's the case, then I would argue the other direction. Then if you're not going to let me have free access to this for the sake of letting anyone have access to it at all, then they should require video game companies like Nintendo, Microsoft, and Sony to allow everyone's digital catalog to continue to evolve with them as the hardware and the companies are in business. So, for example, every time a new iPhone comes out and we buy the new iPhone, I'm on iPhone number 14 right now, right? This thing's been around for a decade and a half. Every single music, movie thing that I have purchased from decades ago, I can still listen to it when I get my brand new iPhone.
Yeah.
So if you're going to not understand the importance of that, then just start making Nintendo stop releasing Super Mario World for the 10th time for $5. Like, it show customer loyalty and respect. If anything, this country is founded on commercialism and capitalism. And if you want to argue that it's not preservation based off of theirs, fine. Great. Then let's go the other direction and argue it's not capitalistic or commercialistic that these companies continue to screw their consumer base, because you could argue that the average Nintendo fan is addicted to the platform of Nintendo because they just keep doing it over and over and over and over again. And there is more than decades of evidence to prove that Nintendo has done that. So I don't know. That pisses me off that the ESA would argue that. And because to me, the person loses the most is the fans and the would-be fans and the would-be people who are going to look at the Wii U 30 years from now and go, what the hell was this archaic piece of hardware? How did they actually use it? And
were there games for toddlers?
Yes. was there a karaoke game to teach you your basics of farm knowledge and animal appreciation
and
on the
Wii U?
Whether
this black sheep has any wool. Great. I think we need to wrap up. So any final thoughts here? I feel like I did my closing argument here already.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we are on the right track here. This obviously was an enormous, enormous project, and hopefully we've done an okay job of explaining how it's very helpful actually to like the wider argument and the wider world of preservation, and also how it is only step one of many to actually fixing this horrible mess.
Yeah. Gerard, for those who don't already consume your content and have been enjoying you on the show, how can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at youtube.com/thatonevideogamer, or just search The Completionist on Twitch, on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on whatever social platform is your preference.
Just search the Google.
Yeah, just search The Completionist and you'll find my dumb bearded face there all over the place. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Gerard. This won't be the last time. We'll figure out how to get you back on here.
I'll find a way.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.